Who's a good boy, then? Nanny's got a bowl of fish eggs for a good boy, said Nanny, trying to see under the big dresser in the kitchen.
Fish eggs? Said Granny, coldly.
I borrowed them from the stuff they have done for the soiree, said Nanny.
Borrowed? Said Granny.
That's right. Come along, Greeball. Who's a good boy, then?
Borrowed? You mean when the cat's finished with them, you're going to give them back?
It's only a manner of speaking, Esme, said Nanny in a hurt little voice. It's not the same as stealing if you don't mean it.
Come along, boy, here's some lovely fish eggs for you.
Grebo pulled himself further into the shadows. There was a little sigh from Christine, and she folded up into a faint. But she managed, Agnes noticed sourly, to collapse in a way that probably didn't hurt when she hit the ground, and which showed off her dress to the best effect. It was beginning to dawn on Agnes that Christine was remarkably clever in some specialised ways. She looked back at the mask.
"It's all right," she said, her voice sounding hoarse even to her. "I know why you're doing it. I really do."
No expression could cross that ivory face, but the eyes flickered. Agnes swallowed. The Perdita part of her wanted to give in right now, because that would be more exciting. But she stood her ground.
"You want to be something else, and you're stuck with what you are," said Agnes. "I know all about that. You're lucky. All you have to do is put on a mask. At least you're the right shape."
"But why did you have to go and kill people?"
"Why? Mr. Pounder couldn't have done you any harm.
But he poked around in odd places, didn't he? And he found something." The ghost nodded slightly, and then held out his ebony cane. He grasped both ends and pulled, so that a long, thin sword slid out.
"I know who you are," Agnes burst out as he stepped forward. "I could probably help you. It might not have been your fault."
She backed away. "I haven't done anything to you. You don't have to be afraid of me." She backed away further as the figure advanced. The eyes in the dark hollows of the mask glinted like tiny jewels.
"I'm your friend, don't you see? Please, Walter. Walter!"
There was, far off, an answering sound that seemed as loud as thunder and as impossible in the circumstances as a chocolate kettle. It was a clank of a bucket handle.
"What's the matter, Miss Perdita Knit?"
The ghost hesitated. There was the sound of footsteps, irregular footsteps. The ghost lowered the sword, opened a door in a piece of scenery painted to represent a castle wall, bowed ironically and slipped away. Walter rounded a corner. He was an unlikely knight-errant. For one thing, he had on evening dress, obviously designed for someone of a different shape. He was still wearing his beret. He also wore an apron and was carrying a mop and bucket. But no heroic lance-wielding rescuer ever galloped over a drawbridge more happily. He was practically surrounded by a golden glow.
"Walter?
What's the matter with Miss Christine?"
She fainted, said Agnes. Probably the excitement with the opera tonight. Yes, probably the excitement, because of the opera tonight.
Walter gave her a slightly worried look.
"Yes," he said, and added patiently, "I know where there's a medicine box. Shall I get it?"
Christine groaned and fluttered her eyelashes.
"Where am I?"
Perdita gritted Agnes's teeth. "Where am I?" That didn't sound the sort of thing someone said when they woke up from a faint. Sounded more like the sort of thing they said because they'd heard it was the sort of thing people said.
"You fainted," she said.
She looked hard at Walter.
"Why were you in here, Walter?"
"Got to mop out the stagehand's privy, Miss Knit. Always having trouble. I've been working on it for months."
"But you're wearing evening dress."
"Yes, then I got to be a waiter afterwards because we're short-handed and there's no one else to be a waiter when they have drinks and sausages on poles before the opera."
No one could have moved that fast. True, Walter and the ghost hadn't both been in the room at the same time, but she'd heard his voice. No one could have had time to duck around behind the piles of flats and turn up at the opposite side of the room in seconds, unless they were some sort of wizard. Some of the girls did say the ghost could almost seem to be in two places at once. Perhaps there were other secret places like the old staircase. Perhaps he... She stopped herself. Walter Plinge wasn't the ghost then. There was no sense in trying to find some excitable explanation to prove wrong right. She'd told Christine. Well, Christine was giving her just a slightly bemused look as Walter helped her up. And she'd told Andre, but he hadn't seemed to believe her, so probably that was all right. Which meant that the ghost was someone else. She'd been so certain.
"You'll enjoy it, Mother, you really will. 'Tain't for the likes of us, Henry. I don't see why Mr. Morecambe couldn't give you tickets to see Nellie Stamp at the music hall. Now that's what I call music. Proper tunes, you can understand. Songs like She Sits Among the Cabbages and Leeks are not very cultural, Mother."
Two figures wandered through the crowds heading for the opera house. This was their conversation.
"It's a good laugh, though, and you don't have to hire suits. Seems daft to me, having to wear a special suit just to listen to music." "It enhances the experience," said young Henry, who had read this somewhere. "I mean, how does the music know?" said his mother. "Now, Nellie Stamp, come along, Mother."
It was going to be one of those evenings, he knew it. Henry Lawsey did his best. And, given the starting point, it wasn't a bad best. He was a clerk in the firm of Morecambe, Slant and Honeyplace, a somewhat old-fashioned legal partnership. One reason for its less-than-modern approach was the fact that Messrs. Morecambe and Honeyplace were vampires, and Mr. Slant was a zombie. The three partners were therefore technically dead, although this did not prevent them putting in a proper day's work, normally during the night, in the case of Mr. Morecambe and Mr. Honeyplace. From Henry's point of view, the hours were good and the job was not onerous, but he chafed somewhat about his promotion prospects because clearly dead men's shoes were being fully occupied by dead men. He decided that the only way to succeed was to better himself by improving his mind, which he tried to do at every opportunity. It is probably a full description of Henry Lawsey's mind that if you had given him a book called How to Improve Your Mind in 5 Minutes, he would have read it with a stopwatch. His progress through life was hampered by his tremendous sense of his own ignorance, a disability which affects all too few people. Mr. Morecambe had given him 2 opera tickets as a reward for sorting out a particularly problematical tort. He'd invited his mother because she represented 100% of all the women he knew. People tended to shake Henry's hand cautiously in case it came off. He'd bought a book about the opera and read it, carefully, because he'd heard that it was absolutely unheard of to go to an opera without knowing what it was about, and the chance of finding out while you were actually watching it was remote. The book's reassuring weight was in his pocket right now. All he needed to complete the evening was a less embarrassing parent.
"Can we get some peanuts before we go in?" said his mother. "Mother, they don't sell peanuts at the opera." "No peanuts? What are you supposed to do if you don't like the songs?"
Grebo's suspicious eyes were 2 glows in the gloom.
"Poke him with a broom handle," suggested Granny.
"No," said Nanny. "With someone like Grebo, you have to use a little bit of kindness."
Granny closed her eyes and waved a hand. There was a yowl from under the kitchen's dresser and a sound of frantic scrabbling. Then his claws scoring tracks in the floor. Grebo came out backwards, fighting all the way.
"Mind you, a lot of cruelty does the trick as well," Nanny conceded. "You've never been much of a cat person, have you, Esme?"
Grebo would have hissed at Granny, except that even his cat brain was just bright enough to realise this was not the best move he could make.
"Give him his fish eggs," Granny said. "He might as well have them now as later."
Grebo inspected the dish. This was all right then. They wanted to give him food. Granny nodded at Nanny Ogg. They held out their hands palm up. Grebo was halfway through the caviar when he felt it happening. He wailed, and then the voice went deeper as his chest expanded and rose physically as his back legs lengthened under him. His ears flattened against his head and then crept down his sides.
"The jacket's a 44-inch chest," said Nanny.
Granny nodded. His face flattened. His whiskers spread out. Grebo's nose developed a life of its own.
"Shit!
You certainly get the hang of it quicker these days," said Nanny.
"You put some clothes on right now, my lad,"
said Granny, who had shut her eyes. Not that this made much difference, she had to admit later. Grebo, fully clothed, still managed to communicate the nakedness beneath. The insouciant moustache, the long sideburns and the tousled black hair, combined with the well-developed muscles to give the impression of the more louche kind of buccaneer, or a romantic poet who'd given up on the opium and tried red meat instead. He had a scar running across his face, and a black patch now where it crossed the eye. When he smiled, he exuded an easy air of undistilled, excitingly dangerous lasciviousness. He could swagger while asleep. Grebo could, in fact, commit sexual harassment simply by sitting very quietly in the next room. Except as far as the witches were concerned. To Granny, a cat was a damn cat, whatever shape it was, and Nanny Ogg always thought of him as Mr. Fluffy. She adjusted the bow tie and stood back critically. "What do you think?" she said.
"He looks like an assassin, but he'll do," said Granny.
"Oh, what a nasty thing to say." Grebo waved his arms experimentally and fumbled with the ebony cane. Fingers took a bit of getting used to, but cat reflexes learned fast. Nanny waved a finger playfully under his nose. He took a half-hearted swipe at it.
"Now you just stay with Granny and do what she tells you like a good boy," she said.
"Yes, Nanny," said Grebo reluctantly. He managed to grip the stick properly. "And no fighting." "No, Nanny." "And no leaving bits of people on the doormat." "No, Nanny." "We'll have no trouble like we did with those robbers last month." "No, Nanny." He looked depressed. Humans had no fun. Incredible complications surrounded the most basic activities. "And no turning back into a cat again until we say, 'Yes, Nanny.' Play your cards right, and there could be a kipper in this for you." "Yes, Nanny."
"What are we going to call him?" said Granny. "He can't just be Grebo, which I've always said was a damn silly name for a cat."
"Well, he looks aristocratic," Nanny began.
"He looks like a beautiful brainless bully," Granny corrected her.
"Aristocratic," repeated Nanny.
"Same thing."
"We can't call him Grebo, anyway."
"We'll think of something."
Salzella leaned disconsolately against the marble banister of the foyer's grand staircase and stared gloomily into his drink. It had always seemed to him that one of the major flaws in the whole business of opera was the audience. They were quite unsuitable, the only ones worse than the ones who didn't know anything at all about music and whose idea of a sensible observation was, "I liked that bit near the end when her voice went wobbly," were the ones who thought they did.
"Want a drink, do you, Mr. Salzella? There's lots, you know."
Walter Plin jambled by, his black suit making him look like a very good class of scarecrow.
"Plinge, you just say, 'Drink, sir,'" said the director of music, "and please take off that ridiculous beret."
"My mum made it for me."
"I'm sure she did, but..."
Bucket sidled up to him.
"Ah, I thought I told you to keep Signor Basilica away from the canapés," he hissed.
"I'm sorry, I couldn't find a big enough crowbar," said Salzella, waving away Walter and his beret. "Anyway, isn't he supposed to be communing with his muse in his dressing room? The curtain goes up in 20 minutes.
"He says he sings better on a full stomach."
"Then we're in for a treat tonight." Bucket turned and surveyed the scene.
"Oh, well, it's going well anyway," he said.
"I suppose so.
The watcher here, you know, in secret. They are mingling..."
"Ah, let me guess." Salzella looked around at the crowds. There was indeed a very short man in a suit intended for a rather larger man. This was especially the case with the opera cloak, which actually trailed on the floor behind him to give the overall impression of a superhero who had spent too much time around the kryptonite. He was wearing a deformed fur hat and trying surreptitiously to smoke a cigarette.
"You mean that little man with the words 'Watchman in disguise' flashing on and off just above his head?"
"Where? Ah, oh, I didn't see that."
Salzella sighed.
"It's Corporal Nobby Nobbs," he said wearily. "The only person to require an identity card to prove his species. I've watched him mingle with 3 large sherries.
"He's not the only one, though," said Mr. Bucket. "They're taking this seriously."
"Oh, yes," said Salzella. "If we look over there, for example, we see Sergeant Detritus, who is a troll, and who is wearing what in the circumstances is actually a rather well-fitting suit. It is therefore, I feel, something of a pity he has neglected to remove his helmet. And these, you understand, the watch has chosen for their ability to blend."
"Well, they'll certainly be useful if the ghost strikes again," said Bucket, hopelessly.
"The ghost would have to..."
Salzella stopped. He blinked.
"Oh, good grief," he whispered. "What has she found?"
Bucket turned.
"That's Lady Esmeralda... Oh."
Grebo strolled in alongside her with the gentle swagger that makes women thoughtful and men's knuckles go white. The buzz of conversation was momentarily hushed and then rose again to a slightly shriller buzz. "I'm impressed," said Sal Zeller.
"He certainly doesn't look like a gentleman," said Bucket. "Look at the colour of that eye."
He set his face into what he hoped was a smile and bowed.
"Well, Lady Esmeralda," he said, "how pleasant to see you again. Won't you introduce us to your guest?"
"This is Lord Gribeau," said Granny. "Mr. Bucket, the owner, and Mr. Salzella, who seems to run the place."
"Ha ha," said Salzella.
Gribeau snarled, revealing longer incisors than any that Bucket had seen outside a zoo. And Bucket had never seen such a greenish-yellow eye. The pupil was all wrong.
"Ha ha," he said, and may I order you something?"
"He'll have milk," said Granny firmly.
"I expect he has to keep up his strength," said Salzella.
Granny spun around. Her expression would have etched steel.
"Anyone for a drink?"
said Nanny Ogg, appearing out of nowhere with a tray and adroitly stepping between them like a very small peacekeeping force.
"Got a bit of everything here."
"Including a glass of milk, I see," said Bucket.
Salzella looked from one witch to the other.
"That's remarkably foresighted of you," he said.
"Well, you never know," said Nanny.
Gribeau took the glass in both hands and lapped at it with his tongue. Then he looked at Salzella.
"What you're looking at? Never seen milk drunk before?"
"Never quite like that, I must admit." Nanny winked at Granny Weatherwax as she turned to scurry away. Granny caught her arm.
"Remember," she whispered, "when we go into the box, you keep an eye on Mrs. Plinge. Mrs. Plinge knows something. I ain't sure what's going to happen, but it is going to happen."
"Right," said Nanny.
She bustled off, muttering under her breath.
"Oh, yes, do this, do that."
"Drink here, please, ma'am."
Nanny looked down.
"Good grief," she said. "What are you?"
The apparition in the fur hat winked at her.
"I'm the Count de Nobs," it said. "And this here," it added, indicating a mobile wall, "is the Count de Tritus."
Nanny glanced at the troll.
"Another count? I'm sure there's unaccountably more counts here than I can count. And what can I get you, officers?" she said.
"Officers? Oh, us," said the Count de Nobs. "What makes you think we're watchmen?"
"Well, he's got a helmet on," Nanny pointed out. "Also, he's got his badge pinned on his coat."
"I told you to put it away,"
Nobby hissed. He looked at Nanny and smiled uneasily.
"Military chic," he said. "It's just a fashion accessory. Actually, we are gentlemen of means and have nothing to do with the city watch whatsoever."
"Well, gentlemen, would you like some wine?"
"Not while we're on duty, thanks," said the troll.
"Oh, yes, thank you very much, Count Detritus," said Nobby bitterly. "Oh, yes, very undercover, that is. Why don't you just wave your truncheon around where everyone can see it?"
"Well, if you think it'd help..."
"Put it away."
The Count Detritus's eyebrows met with the effort of thought.
"That was irony, then, was it? To a superior officer?"
"Can't be a superior officer, can you? 'Cause we ain't watchmen. Look, Commander Vimes explained it 3 times.
Nanny Ogg tactfully moved away. It was bad enough watching them blow their cover without sucking at it as well. This was a new world, all right. She was used to a life where the men wore the bright clothes and the women wore black. It made it a lot easier to decide what to put on in the mornings. But inside the opera house, the rules of clothing were all in reverse, just like the laws of common sense. Here, the women dressed like frosted peacocks, and the men looked like penguins. So, there were coppers here. Nanny Ogg was basically a law-abiding person when she had no reason to break the law, and therefore had that kind of person's attitude to law enforcement officers, which was one of deep and permanent distrust. There was their approach to theft, for example. Nanny had a witch's view of theft, which was a lot more complicated than the attitude adopted by the law, and if it came to it, people who owned property were stealing. They tended to wield the huge, blunt axe of the law in circumstances that required the delicate scalpel of common sense. No, thought Nanny, policemen with their great big boots were not required here on a night like this. it would be a good idea to put a thumbtack under the ponderous feet of justice. She ducked behind a gilt statue and fumbled in the recesses of her clothing while people nearby looked around in puzzlement at the erratic twanging of elastic. She was sure she had one around somewhere. She'd packed it in case of emergencies. There was the clink of a small bottle. Ah, yes. A moment later, Nanny Ogg emerged decorously with two small glasses on her tray and headed purposefully for the watchman.
"Fruit drink, officers?" she said. "Oh, silly me, what am I saying? I didn't mean officers. Home-made fruit drink?"
Detritus sniffed suspiciously, immediately clearing his sinuses.
"What's in it?" he said.
"Apples," said Nanny Ogg promptly. "Well, mainly apples." Under her hand, a couple of spilt drops finished eating their way through the metal of the tray and dropped onto the carpet where they smoked. The auditorium buzzed with the sound of opera-goers settling down and Mrs. Lawsey trying to find her shoes.
"You really shouldn't have taken them off, Mother. My feet are giving me chip. Did you bring your knitting? I think I must have left it in the ladies."
"Oh, Mother!"
Henry Lawsey marked his place in his book and raised his runny eyes heavenward and blinked. Right above him, a long way above him, was a glittering circle of light. His mother followed his gaze.
"What's that, then?" "I think it's a chandelier, Mother. It's a pretty big one. What's holding it up?" "I'm sure they've got special ropes and things, Mother. Looks a bit dangerous to my mind." "I'm sure it's absolutely safe, Mother. What do you know about chandeliers? I'm sure people wouldn't come into the opera house if there was any chance of a chandelier dropping on their heads, Mother," said Henry, trying to read his book.
"Il truccatore, the master of disguise. Il truccatore, tenor, a mysterious nobleman, causes scandal in the city when he woos high-born ladies while disguised as their husbands. However, Laura, soprano, the new bride of Capriccio, baritone, refuses to give in to his blandishments." Henry put a bookmark in the book, took a smaller book from his pocket and carefully looked up blandishments. He was moving in a world he wasn't quite sure of. Embarrassment lay waiting at every turn, and he wasn't going to get caught out over a word. Henry lived his life in permanent dread of being asked questions later. And with the help of his servant, Wingy, tenor, he adopts a subterfuge. The dictionary came out again for a moment, culminating, and again, in the scene at the famous masked ball at the Duke's palace. But Il Truccatore has not reckoned with his old adversary, the Count de...
"Adversary," Henry sighed, and reached for his pocket.
Curtain up in 5 minutes. Salzella reviewed his troops. They consisted of scene-builders and painters and all those other employees who could be spared for the evening. At the end of the line, about 50% of Walter Plinge had managed to stand to attention.
"Now, you all know your positions," said Salzella, "and if you see anything at all, you are to let me know at once. Do you understand?"
"Mr. Salzella?"
"Yes, Walter?"
"We mustn't interrupt the opera, Mr. Salzella."
Salzella shook his head. "People will understand, I'm sure."
"Show must go on, Mr. Salzella."
"Walter, you will do what you're told."
Someone raised a hand.
"He's got a point, though, Mr. Salzella."
Salzella rolled his eyes.
"Just catch the ghost," he said. "If we can do it without a lot of shouting, that's good. Of course I don't want to stop the show."
He saw them relax. A deep chord rolled out over the stage.
"What the hell was that?"
Salzella strode behind the stage and was met by André, looking excited.
"What's going on?"
"We repaired it, Mr. Salzella. Only, well, he doesn't want to give up the seat." The librarian nodded at the director of music. Salzella knew the orangutan, and among the things he knew was that if the librarian wanted to sit somewhere, then that was where he sat. But he was a first-class organist, Salzella had to admit. His lunchtime recitals in the Great Hall of Unseen University were extremely popular, especially since the university's organ had every single sound effect that bloody stupid Johnson's inverted genius had been able to contrive. No one would have believed, before a pair of simian hands had worked on the project, that something like Doyenoff's romantic Prelude in G could be rescored for whoopee cushion and squashed rabbits. "There's the overtures," said André, "and the ballroom scene."
"At least get him a bow tie," said Salzella.
"No one can see him, Mr. Salzella, and he hasn't really got much of a neck." We do have standards, André.
Yes, Mr. Salzella. Since you seem to have been relieved of employment this evening, then perhaps you could help us apprehend the ghost.
Certainly, Mr. Salzella. Fetch him a tie, then, and come with me. A little later, left to himself, the librarian opened his copy of the score and placed it carefully on the stand. He reached down under the seat and pulled out a large brown paper bag of peanuts. He wasn't entirely sure why André, having talked him into playing the organ this evening, had told the other man that it was because he, the librarian, wouldn't budge. In fact, he'd got some interesting cataloguing to do and had been looking forward to it. Instead, he seemed to be here for the night, although a pound of shelled peanuts was handsome pay by any ape's standards. The human mind was a deep and abiding mystery, and the librarian was glad he didn't have one any more. He inspected the bow tie. As André had foreseen, it presented certain problems to someone who'd been behind the door when the necks were handed out. Granny Weatherwax stopped in front of Box 8 and looked around. Mrs. Plinge wasn't visible. She unlocked the door with what was probably the most expensive key in the world.
"And you behave yourself," she said.
"Yes, Granny," moaned Gribo.
"No going to the lavatory in the corners."
"No, Granny."
Granny glared at her escort. Even in a bow tie, even with his fine moustaches waxed, he was still a cat. You just couldn't trust them to do anything except turn up for meals. The inside of the box was rich red plush, picked out with gilt decoration. It was like a soft little private room. There were a couple of fat pillars on either side, supporting part of the weight of the balcony above. She looked over the edge and noted the drop to the stalls below. Of course, someone could probably climb in from one of the adjacent boxes, but that would be in full view of the audience and would be bound to cause some comment. She peeked under the seats. She stood on a chair and felt around the ceiling, which had gilt stars on it. She inspected the carpet minutely. She smiled at what she saw. She'd been prepared to bet that she knew how the ghost got in, and now she was certain. Gribo spat on his hand and tried ineffectually to groom his hair.
"You sit quiet and eat your fish eggs," said Granny.
"Yes, Granny."
"And watch the opera. It's good for you."
"Yes, Granny."
"Evening, Mrs. Plinge," said Nanny cheerfully. "Ain't this exciting? The buzz of the audience, the air of expectation, the blokes in the orchestra finding somewhere to hide the bottles and trying to remember how to play. All the exhilaration and drama of the operatic experience waiting to unfold."
"Oh, hello, Mrs. Ogg," said Mrs. Plinge.
She was polishing glasses in her tiny bar.
"Certainly very packed," said Nanny.
She looked sidelong at the old woman. It was central to Nanny Ogg's soul that she never considered herself an old woman, while, of course, availing herself of every advantage that other people's perceptions of her as such would bring.
"Every seat sold, I heard."
This didn't achieve the expected reaction.
"Shall I give you a hand cleaning out Box 8? She went on.
"Oh, I cleaned it out last week,"
said Mrs. Plinge. She held up a glass to the light.
"Yes, but I hear her ladyship is very particular," said Nanny, "very picky about things."
"What ladyship?"
"Mr. Bucket has sold Box 8, see?"
said Nanny. She heard a faint tinkle of glass. "Ah." Mrs. Plinge appeared at the doorway of her nook.
"But he can't do that."
"It's his opera house," said Nanny, watching Mrs. Plinge carefully. "I suppose he thinks he can."
"It's the ghost's box."
Opera-goers were appearing along the corridor.
"I shouldn't think he'd mind just for one night," said Nanny Ogg. "The show must go on, eh?
Are you all right, Mrs. Plinge?" "I think I'd better just go and..."
she began, stepping forward.
"No, you have a good sit-down and a rest,"
said Nanny, pressing her back with gentle but irresistible force.
"But I should go and..."
"And what, Mrs. Plinge?"
said Nanny. The old woman went pale. Granny Weatherwax could be nasty, but the nastiness was always in the window. You were aware that it might turn up on the menu. Sharpness from Nanny Ogg, though, was like being bitten by a friendly dog. It was all the worse for being unexpected.
"I dare say you wanted to go and have a word with somebody. Did you, Mrs. Plinge?"
said Nanny softly.
"Someone who might be a little shocked to find his box full, perhaps. I reckon I could put a name to that someone, Mrs. Plinge. Now, if
The old woman's hand came up, holding a bottle of champagne, and then came down hard in an effort to launch the SS Githa Og onto the seas of unconsciousness. The bottle bounced. Then Mrs. Plinge leapt past and scuttled away, her polished little black boots twinkling. Nanny Og caught the doorframe and swayed a little, while blue and purple fireworks went off behind her eyes. But there was dwarf in the Og ancestry, and that meant a skull you could go mining with. She stared muzzily at the bottle.
"Year of the insulted goat," she mumbled. "That's a good year."
Then consciousness gained the upper hand. She grinned as she galloped after the retreating figure. In Mrs. Plinge's place, she'd have done exactly the same thing, except a good deal harder.